Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Thanks, everybody, for coming. So I'm hoping this is going to be kind of a fun panel that's going to sort of give you some war stories, but also leave you feeling kind of empowered with some practical tips for things you can do to protect your users while protecting yourself, and also things that you should be asking your service providers to do to protect you, depending on where you sit. So my name is Corinne McSherry, and I am with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And for those of you who don't know what we do, we are a digital civil liberties organization. We sort of think of ourselves as the 911 of the internet, and other people think of us that way too, based on the phone calls we get. And so we focus a lot on trying to protect speech online, trying to protect privacy online, trying to make sure that people can innovate without undue restriction, people can communicate without undue restriction, and sort of everybody gets protected, and the Constitution makes it intact into the 21st century. From that vantage point, you know, because we're sort of this 911 of the internet, you know, we get the call. We get, well, actually, it's usually not a call. Who are we kidding? We get the email. We get the IM when someone finds that their privacy is under threat or their speech is under threat. And from that vantage point, we've identified what we've come to call the weakest link problem. And that is this. It's pretty simple, and it's kind of what it sounds like, which is that, so the internet is this fantastic resource for communicating with the world. It's a great resource for marketing. It's a great resource for speech. It's a great resource for storage. We see with, like, the rise of cloud computing mechanisms. It's this fantastic resource for all kinds of things. But it depends on a whole set of service providers, intermediaries, for all of that to work. So those could be payment processors, those could be ISPs, those could be web hosting services, all of the above. And all of us rely on them to reach out to audiences, for example. You know, the line between the speaker and the audience depends on a series of links. And the problem that can happen is that any one of those links might be a weak link in the chain. Any one of those intermediaries might be under pressure of various kinds to give up information about their users in response to a subpoena, for example, to take down content in response to a threat that a given set of piece of content is infringing. They might get a notice, and then they might say, well, I better take this down, or I might get in legal trouble. And even if the content is legal, they don't want to invest the time and resources in keeping it up. They might get hit with a trademark threat. They might see a trademark threat. Like, I have a client who, they are urban homesteaders, which is they're people who, you know, grow chickens and farm in a city. And they engage in urban homesteading. It's a whole movement of people who engage in urban homesteading. And unbeknownst to almost everyone in this movement, there is one little group in Pasadena, California, that got a trademark on the term urban homesteading. And then they used this trademark to send notices to Facebook saying, you need to take down all these pages about urban homesteading because it infringes our trademarks. And Facebook said, we don't want to get in the middle of this, so we're going to go ahead and take it down. Let us know if you guys work it out. So in the meantime, all these pages are taken down. Facebook has become a weak link in the communication train, or I'm sorry, the chain communication chain, because, of course, this trademark is completely bogus, but now we have to go to the trademark office and get them to cancel the mark before my clients can get their page back up. That's too bad. That's a lot of trouble, and there aren't a lot of free IP lawyers to do stuff like that. Another example that we've seen just last week is a situation where PayPal has threatened or told a number of publishers of erotica that they will terminate their accounts if they don't stop, or I'm sorry, they will stop processing payments if they don't stop selling certain kinds of legal erotic fiction that fall within certain categories. PayPal says, sorry, this is just our policy. No, you know, it's not personal, but this is just something we feel we need to do. So now those publishers are in a difficult place, and they feel like, well, you know, we need our PayPal account in order to continue. And we don't want to be editing the content that we sell based on what's in it, but you know, we're between a rock and a hard place, right? So PayPal has become a weak link in the chain. Another place we've seen it is situations where you have mass subpoenas for people's identifying information, which copyright trolls, people who bring mass copyright lawsuits, they have those subpoenas issued, and then they use it. Once they get the personally identifying information, they send takedown or they send settlement demands to those people, and they say, look, we're going to name you in this lawsuit. We're going to sue you by name for copyright infringement of maybe a pornographic movie unless you settle with us for $2,000 or $2,500 or something like that. And this has turned into a very profitable business model for a few people. Again, that's a place where, you know, if you're an ISP and you get a subpoena, well, that's a court order. You need to deal with it. But maybe there's a way to deal with it where you don't, again, become a weak link in the chain, in this sense, in the sense of protecting your users' privacy. So the good news is that from our vantage point at EFF, we've also found that there are service providers of various kinds, intermediaries of various kinds, who have come up with creative ways to protect their users. Make sure they stay on the right side of the law, but going maybe that extra mile to serve their customers. And some of those people are right here today. And so this is Chris Mooney from Project DoD.
Hi.
And they'll say a little bit more about what they do in a second. Randy Cadenhead from Cox Communication. And Ethan Oberman, who runs a service called Spider Oak. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to turn it over to them to talk a little bit about some of the things that they do, and then we're going to make it a little more interactive. I've got some questions for them, and hopefully at a certain point you guys will have some questions as well. So why don't we let Randy start?
If you can't hear, please let me know, but I'll try and speak up. My name is Randy Cadenhead, and I am the privacy lawyer for Cox Communications. You can find me at privacy@cox.com. It's available on the internet if you can't remember it, and there are 6 million of our customers who know and use that email address regularly to reach out to me with issues that some of which we'll talk about today. We do have about 4 million roughly internet customers. We do business in various markets around the country, from the Northeast through some places in Florida, and a great deal along the West in Arizona, Nevada, and California. One of our missions is to be the most trusted provider of services in the marketplace, and that's what we try to do on a regular basis. It's what my job is, and part of being here is to help educate people who are here today about the importance of what we can do to help you protect yourselves. I've been asked to kick things off by talking a little bit about the DMCA to sort of lay some groundwork, and I'll do that here for just a minute. The DMCA is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, if you don't know. It, unlike the internet, was actually invented by Al Gore. It is a law that was established to put a regimen around copyright infringement over the internet. Specifically, it was designed to deal with hosted copyrighted works, as opposed to what we see most of the time now, which is content that is passed along by peer-to-peer, hosted by one's own self, or put up in the cloud. And so the law, technology, has surpassed the law once again in this particular area, but the law was designed for hosted content and tends to be applied, roughly speaking, as a model for peer-to-peer and other related content sharing mechanisms. In our company, we get about 1 million and change takedown notices in a year. The way the law works is a person who believes that their copyrighted works have been infringed sends a notice to the internet.
Can you just do a little bit louder?
Okay, we'll try that.
Pretty quiet in the back.
A copyright owner sends a notice to a provider, such as Cox. Cox uses the model of the hosted provider concept in all circumstances, all copyright circumstances. But we forward that on to the customer. The customer has an opportunity then to contact us back and provide what's called a counter notice, which says, sorry, it's not infringing. And if that occurs, that generally closes the matter. We notify the complaining party of that, and it generally tends to go away, but sometimes it doesn't. If we don't get a notice back, we can, and sometimes do, take down the hosted content. If it's not hosted, there's not a whole lot we can do under the DMCA itself. But you'll see as we talk later that the model tends to carry over into other forms of communication and sharing. I'll stop at that point and we'll move on.
So I'm going to go next. My name is Chris Mooney. I'm a software engineer and infrastructure hacker. I am a software engineer at Craigslist.org, which I know it's kind of rare to find anybody that actually works at Craigslist, so here I am, like, where's Waldo? But that's not why I'm here today. I was actually invited because I'm also the executive director of Project DoD, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to, say, censorship-resistant hosting on the Internet. We try and do a little bit more with innovation of certain technologies that allow people to recognize, I don't know, their fundamental human rights and whatnot, but our flagship service is censorship-resistant hosting. We've been around for 14 years, and in that time, we've seen a lot of different types of censorship. We've seen plenty of governments go after users, and we've seen legislation that winds up being not great, and that leads to things like the DMCA. And over the last decade, we've seen a lot of Digital Millennium Copyright takedown abuse, which is what Randy was kind of just talking about, that process. Well, that process is very easy to abuse. And so we're what a lot of people would consider a host of last resort, which I know most people wouldn't build their thing that way, but we're an all-volunteer-run nonprofit. So if you're hosting at, like, GoDaddy, and some inscrupulous character comes along and says, hey, there's copyrighted content on that website, even though there isn't, GoDaddy typically doesn't have the resources to investigate it, and they just take your content down. And then you typically don't know why that happened, and so people will wind up, if they do the right internet searches, they'll find us, they'll host the content, and we'll try and do a little bit better about, let's say, at least following the process of counter notice in the DMCA, which it sounds crazy to think that just following that is a major contribution to copyright, I'm sorry, to censorship resistance, but it is the case. So I was going to talk a little bit more about Project DoD, but I wanted to, this audience is sort of unique in that there's, in fact, actually, I know I'm in good company because there's some startups here. I know there's people that work at companies that are trying to do stuff, online service providers and whatnot. And I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about this idea of where people should innovate at startups. So think of the domain of all things that that people can actually innovate in that make money. And that's a pretty saturated domain. There's a lot of people working in that area. And then there's another domain of places where people can innovate to try and benefit their users or to sort of help their users realize those fundamental human rights. And I'm going to make the argument that there's an intersection set between these two things and that it's a really good idea if you're a startup or if you're an established online service provider and you're trying to innovate a service that that you try and think in the domain of things that are good for humanity. Consequently, I work at Craigslist, and they started out sort of the same way. There was no notion that they wanted to make money. They just, you know, wanted to do something good by their users, and it wound up being a profitable model anyway. So then on DoD, there's a couple areas that we've recognized that people can really contribute to help censorship resistance. And there's one sort of overwhelming guideline, which is that if you can make your service jurisdictionally or organizationally diverse. So in the early days of the Internet was very diverse because it was supposed to withstand attack. in the last decade, we've moved away from that model. And if we can go back a little bit to having our services be slightly more organizationally diverse and jurisdictionally diverse, you can give your users a lot of protection, and you can do exactly what this talk is talking about. Also, data retention, you know, really think about how long you need to keep data of your users. That's one thing that we try to do is only keep data as long as we absolutely need it or have it in databases that roll over every, say, 24 or 48 hours. And you have to strike a balance there.
Let me interrupt you for a second. And why would you do that? Why?
So as far as, I mean, basically what happens is that it's a subpoena vector, right? So in this country, it's a subpoena vector. In other countries, it could be a death sentence. I'm not trying to be, you know, that's not trying to be hyperbole. I mean, it really can be a death sentence in other countries. In this country, it can become a subpoena vector. Not all subpoenas are the sort of things that we want them to be. That is, like law enforcement trying to catch a murderer or a rapist or something like that, right? Subpoenas come in many different forms. They come in the form of really nasty civil subpoenas. Legal subpoenas can come in that are politically motivated. There's a lot of reasons there to not allow law enforcement or other people to go on fishing expeditions for that data. So you really kind of want to think about that. Think about your data retention and how long you need to keep it. And the last thing, actually, this will probably play right into Ethan's stuff, is that you should really think about putting your users' data in their control let's say their configuration data in their control. Don't let a single admin, ruin that data. These are just things that we've seen on DoD. When I say ruin that data, I mean like don't let them mutate it. You don't want an admin to be the weak point in a network that's supposed to be censorship resistant. So those are the types of things that we think about when we're trying to develop new stuff. And I'm going to toss it over to Ethan.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Hello, Ethan Oberman from Spider Oak. So we come at this from a little bit different angle than my colleagues over to my left here. We are a cloud online backup synchronization and sharing service. And we created what we call our zero-knowledge privacy environment. And what that means is that the data that our users upload to Spider Oak, it retains full privacy. It's uploaded encrypted, it's stored encrypted, and it's not decrypted until it's back on that user's machine. What that means is that even our admins, to Chris's point, even our admins with direct physical access to the box cannot actually access any plaintext data on our users under any circumstances. So the government subpoena issue, if you will, becomes almost a non-issue for us because we actually cannot turn over plaintext data to anyone. Several years ago when we started the company, it was a very unique approach to thinking about user privacy and understanding how we can really be at arm's length from our users, allow them to have a really secure and private place to store this data and do it in a way so that we didn't have to actually get involved in dealing with a lot of the issues that come up around copyright infringement and subpoenas and other similar issues. So we've definitely come at it from that tact. It's been good. I think the privacy understanding, concept is one that is growing quickly and people are becoming more aware of how much data they have circulating in the internet and how valuable it is and how important it is to make sure that it does stay private. And that's what we really focus on. So I will turn it back over to Corinne and I know she's got some more questions.
So I have some kind of general questions for the panel and then I'm hoping at a certain point we'll open it up to you guys, and you'll have some questions as well. So let's sort of dig in just a little bit here. So we've talked a little bit about the DMCA process already. And are people generally familiar with the DMCA? I know Randy gave you a short. Okay, good. So we don't need to. Everyone wants a safe harbor. Safe harbor equals good. That said, so you want to stay within the safe harbors. But when you get a DMCA notice, is there a spectrum of options in terms of responding to it? I mean, is it just like take down within an hour or no safe harbor for you, or is there some flexibility there?
You want to go?
I'll start by giving the traditional ISP response. When you get a million DMCA takedown notices in a year, you have to come up with a way to automate them in order to deal with them at all. And we have done that, and our approach generally is to forward a DMCA notice to a customer with some explanation as to what it is and what it's about, and give the customer an opportunity to respond before we take any further action. As a general matter, we don't take anyone down as a result of a notice until we've received a number of notices indicating that there's a likelihood that there really is infringement. That's not always true. We try to remain flexible because customers' issues and circumstances vary. But that sort of sets the groundwork for the way a large ISP tends to operate. Go ahead.
So we're a little bit smaller, and when we get takedown notices, we tend to have a little bit more personal attention to them. So when we get a takedown notice, we first thing right away is you have the right to, as an online service provider, you have the right to ask for a clarification of the elements of notification. And so we immediately spit it back to make sure that every single element of notification is accurate and is accurate, because that's necessary if the user on our service wants to file a counter notice. That is, if you're not just going to blanketly take the content down, you need to make sure that you've got an accurate notice, and in order for them to even be able to counter notice accurately. So by doing that, we wind up seeing a very, very large number of these notices go away. So most people don't come back after that. That's if you want to maintain your safe harbor. You can also choose not to maintain your safe harbor. And there are situations where that may occur that is a good idea. If you get a really abusive takedown notice, let's just call them like a troll. So they're sending a lot of takedown notices to you. If you go through the entire process of counter notice and then they continue to send takedown notices for the same content, we've chosen in those cases to waive our safe harbor and say, no, we're not going to take this content down. So.
And what about repeat infringer policies? And for those who aren't aware of this, one of the requirements of the DMCA is that you have some sort of policy for the termination of repeat infringers. And the idea is that, you know, there should be some point at which you draw the line, and content owners don't have to keep sending you notices over and over regarding the same account. You know, so you can see some sense there. One of the things, though, is that the DMCA is actually not specific about what that policy has to be. A lot of companies have adopted three strikes policies, but one of the things that I've seen from being at EFF is I had a client who reached out to us who had their account taken down. They were an animal welfare group, and they posted videos of abuse of animals at rodeos, videos that they had taken themselves. And they, the Professional Radio Cowboys Association does not like this group and does not like what they do. And so they issued 13 takedown notices over the course of a week and a half to YouTube to get these videos taken down. And as a result of that, because at that time YouTube had a three strikes policy, which many people have, three strikes and your account is terminated. They would let you counter notice and so on, but that takes time. That takes several weeks before you can actually get your account reinstated. And so basically in the middle of a fundraising season, very important time for them, they had their account taken down. And these notices, to be clear, were completely bogus because the Professional Radio and Cowboys Association had no copyrights in those videos. They didn't make the videos. They had no ownership of them. They were utterly wrong from the start, and we sued them, and that was a whole other thing. But in the meantime, my client had their account taken down. So that's a long sort of setup, but, you know, is there flexibility in repeat infringer policies, and are there things that a company can do to make sure that their customers' accounts aren't taken down while staying within the safe harbors?
I'll explain from the Cox standpoint the way we operate. First of all, if we receive copyright infringement takedown notices that are of questionable content. We generally don't deal with those at all. We have seen some demands come in where they include not just we want you to take down this content, but please forward the following notice to your customer. We see that you're infringing our copyright. We demand X number of thousands of dollars or else. And those are what we would consider to be outside the scope of a proper DMCA notice, and we don't forward those. But those that we do forward, we do treat on an automated basis for a series of notices. At some point, we will put a customer up on the we will put a notice up on the customer's browser to explain that they need to contact us and talk to one of our Tier 2 reps about a problem that seems to be occurring. And so we never take any of our graduated response actions until somebody has actually talked to a live person who knows what he's talking about. Generally, those kind of things tend to take care of the problem. If they don't, that's fine, and we'll all move on. But there are actions that you can take or not take, depending on the circumstances, and many times they do vary based upon the user.
So I would say I think there's a lot of variance in how you handle repeat offenders. So if, let's say, it's definitely a copyrighted movie or some sort of copyrighted material that's on our service and the user were to continually violate that copyright, we're compelled by U.S. law to do something about that. So let's say they repeatedly infringed, but they never counter-noticed. It was sort of clearly a copyright violation. I mean, at some point you have to terminate the account. But I've found that in a lot of cases, if the user winds up following the process of counter notification, that it should really be a reset on whether or not they're a repeat infringer. And so let's say we had this case. It was it's a group of psychologists, psychiatrists. They practice this thing called attachment therapy, and it's this holding therapy thing where they pin children down. I don't know, they're like 6 or 7 year old children, and they basically hold them down until they submit, and then they get like sort of embarrassingly coddled. It's supposed to reset the whole like attachment process, and So then there's this whole group of people out there that are trying to show that this thing is a bad idea, that it's scientifically, you know, there's no merit to it, that it's actually harmful. And so this whole group of people is out there hosting, and this group of doctors are trying to take the counter-argument. This is a scientific process, right? So they're trying to take the peer review element out of the entire thing. They're taking the content down all over the internet. They wound up on us, and when they did, our users were, this is just sort of amazing to me, they weren't allowed to follow the process of counter-notification at multiple ISPs, and so they finally did with us, and we allowed them to counter-notify, but then these doctors continue to send takedown stuff for the same exact content they'd already sent takedown stuff for. And in that case, I don't think it's a repeat infringement. I think you should stand up for your user in that case. That's where I would suggest ignoring your safe harbor, because you're probably well within your rights at that point, and it's time consuming to follow that process. So I think you can make a good argument if you ever did have to go to court for it. We had one other fun situation. I don't know if anybody's seen this yet. It's the user's talking about something. They take content down. They get a DMCA notice to take content down, and they take that content down. But then they put the DMCA notice up in its place. And then you get another takedown notice for the DMCA takedown notice. I don't really think that that's a fair repeat infringement policy. So I would say don't count that as repeat infringement either. At the time, our upstream provider did, and we moved upstream providers as a result. So, that's how we handle repeat infringement.
Okay, so this all sounds like a lot of trouble. Doing all this review and human people on the phone and, you know, could you guys sort of walk through a little bit your cost-benefit analysis with the efforts you kind of make to go that extra mile for your customers. And maybe we'll start with Ethan, let him get in on this conversation.
Thanks. It is hard, actually, to fight for your users. I mean, this is not, it's not an easy thing to do, and it is differently represented based on who you are and where you come at this problem from. For us, coming up with a way to basically ensure our users' privacy was hard. We had to engage a lot of thought and a lot of sort of philosophical design around a product, and that led to actually making things a little more complicated for the user, especially when we started. The product was a little more sluggish. It used a lot of CPU because a lot of the encryption has to happen locally if you're going to do it like the way we do it. There's some functionality hit. We can't provide a lot of the same levels of functionality that some of our competitors can because all the data on our servers is encrypted. So we can't do things like show you a sexy preview of something, for example, because it takes us a lot. It's a lot harder for us to do that. So we definitely had to take some pretty severe measures when we started the product about how we were going to walk through this process of making sure that things are private. And it really is something you have to do from step one. You can't put security in or privacy in after the fact in our business. There just end up being too many holes. So it's definitely something that you really have to do from step one. And it is a harder concept to really grasp and to get behind. I mean, privacy is not really one of those things that you could sort of, on Wednesday say, we're going to stand for privacy. And then on Thursday say, well, it's really more convenient for us to do this. We're going to do something else. Some people do that, yes. but it is really something that I think you have to choose from the beginning, and you have to really stand steadfast. And, not to plug the EFF here, but, these guys really do. I mean, it is important. What they do and the work they do is really important for all of us. And for really everybody. And, it's fighting for the right of a user is a complicated thing. And it is something that a lot of people just shy away from because it's too hard or financially it doesn't make sense. To Chris's point, doing things that do good is important. And it certainly has always been important for us. So,
are there benefits from your perspective?
Well, the benefits for us, I'm sorry, that was a lot of the cost side, excuse me.
That's okay.
The benefits for us, we're actually starting to reap now. And we're seeing more of, unfortunately, in this world where things get compromised, we're actually seeing greater benefits in that when companies, individuals, would like to find a more secure and private product on the market, there just aren't a lot out there. And so we have really fit into a very nice alternative, a secure and private alternative, for a lot of these guys, and doing things more, doing things that are harder, I guess, is harder, and therefore not a lot of people do them. But when that becomes the requirement of an industry, and it's certainly becoming the requirements of certainly the enterprise industry, and as we move more into, it's certainly in the consumer industry as well, we certainly have carved out a nice niche for ourselves. So, the benefit is that once you sort of adopt this philosophy of doing things private and I think also, at a larger level, really fighting for your users, I think that carries through. And, the users that come to appreciate and understand that, I think, they've found a home. And that's what we're all trying to do is keep our users happy.
If I could go, I've certainly found that for what Project DoD does, it takes a little bit of extra effort. If you're a smaller company, I highly suggest you do this. I don't think it's going to work that well on a large scale like at Cox Communications. But if you're a smaller company, there's a lot of benefit in picking the right case, right? So you're going to get some really terrible takedown notices. There's clearly going to be abusive notices. And when you see those, you should stand up for your users. And in this case with the doctors that I was talking about, we actually exercised our 512F rights under the DMCA, which is to go after the ISP or the user can do this. So we went after the person sending the takedown notices in court for misrepresentations of copyrighted material. The material he had was like quotes from his talks and quotes from his book. They were academically cited. It's like everything that we've ever been taught to do from high school up to do the right thing. And he was clearly abusing that process. Now, it took a lot. I mean, he was very persistent. He tried every abuse angle possible. It took a lot of effort on our part to defend that user. So when we were done, the benefit was that all of those other users that this guy had trolled on the net and taken down, that the group of doctors had gotten taken down, they all wound up hosting with us. Every last one of them that was opposing this, because we would stand up for them. And they didn't get any takedown notices from this person anymore. And more than that, when we get an initial notice and we give the elements a notification, we let the people that are sending us that that notice know that we're potentially litigious when it comes to our users. And that has defended us quite well. So we're reaping quite a benefit in the early days if you can really make a name for yourself or as standing up for your users. I think there's a huge benefit in the amount of time you'll put in initially.
Ben?
What Chris said earlier, I wrote down, he said, doing good for your customer is a profitable business model. That indeed, I think, is probably a very strong statement and a very good one. We deal with a lot of average customers, not like everybody in the room here. And to them, there are streets in some cities, not here in Austin, of course, where you wouldn't want to walk down alone at night. And there are places on the internet where you, in the virtual sense, don't want to do that. And we try to help our customers know where they're going and be thoughtful about it. If they choose to do that, that's fine. But we want them to know the risks so that they can be educated consumers. And we think that that's a useful thing. We provide education for teens. We do an annual teen summit in Washington. We have parental tools that we offer and things of that nature. And we do that because we think that an internet that people understand and can make decent choices about is the wisest way to act as an ISP.
Okay. So, and I just want to say Randy is being a little bit modest about something that he and a bunch of other service providers are doing for their users, and I just want to tout it a little bit because I think it's pretty great, which is that a number of the service providers who have been gotten hit with subpoenas for the identifying information for literally thousands of people based on allegations of copyright infringement that there's a whole legal process and a lot of abusive process that's happening, but basically there's a lot of lawyers who are using the judicial system to get identifying information for people who use BitTorrent to allegedly download movies, and then they send these settlement demands, as I mentioned earlier. And there's no point, no one intends to litigate these cases. They just want to extract as much money out of as many people as possible. And along the way, they have to stop at the ISP and get the actual identifying information associated with the IP addresses because they're the ones who have it. ISPs are under pressure because they've got a court order. You know, judge tells you to hand over some information, you probably should hand over that information. But a number of the ISPs, in response to a particularly abusive process, have fought back and gone back to court and said, this whole process is utterly improper. And we want you, judge, to please reconsider your order and, you know, think about whether this is really the right thing. Do you really want to make us do this? And I've also asked the judge to say, and if you really are going to say this, because the courts are split around the country, half the courts say one thing, half the courts say another. Some of these suits are getting thrown out, but there's a few jurisdictions that seem to want them. Let us go up to an appellate court and get a ruling, because we don't want to be in a position of handing over our customers' data. Anyway, so Cox is one of them, and I just want to give them some kudos for it. And that's another place. That's not free. They had to pay lawyers, and lawyers aren't cheap, unless they're EFF. We come cheap. We come free. But most lawyers don't come for free, and they're doing that. And, Randy, I'd be interested if you have any thoughts that you feel like you can share about without, you know, breaking privilege or anything, about why you guys made the choice to do that.
I'm not sure everybody's familiar with the specifics of the lawsuits that are occurring these days, but they follow a very common pattern, and it is somewhat interesting. Some lawyers around the country have found what they think is a useful business model, and one that I think some of them believe is legitimately a useful use of their services. But they have teamed up with porn film producers.
You mean copyright trolls?
let me say this: I'm speaking now not as a representative of Cox, but I will say personally that I think you might be giving trolls a bad name. Setting that aside, they filed lawsuits against thousands of individuals in one location, even though they may not be from that location. In fact, generally they are not. So let's say they file in Washington or Virginia. The users may be all over the country, but they file these lawsuits and send a subpoena to an ISP that says who was the person who had this IP address on a given date and time. The subpoenas are generally valid on their face, and most ISPs will respond to them. But some ISPs, some major ones, have begun to resist those for one of several legal reasons. When it is the case that subpoenas have to be responded to, most ISPs, responsible ISPs, take that time to notify their customers that their information has been subpoenaed. In our case, not only do we notify them, but we give them my telephone number. And so far, we've had about 8,000 customers who have been impacted by this. These are real people, and they may or may not, I can't say, have downloaded porn films to their home computers. But whether they have or not, they are real people and they are real customers, and they deserve better legal rights than having to go to some jurisdiction across the country in order to quash the subpoena, as the legal phrase is.
So actually, well, let's talk about this a little bit, because I think, Randy, you started this up. Maybe start to get a little practical takeaways, not all the way, but let's talk about best practices for user privacy. I think, Randy, you mentioned one, which is, if you get a subpoena for someone's identifying information, make sure they know it, and make sure they know it in time. Does that sound about right?
That's well put.
What are some other things that people can do that you guys do to try to protect your users' privacy?
Well, the data retention thing I was telling you about, there's nothing to subpoena if you don't have the data. So really ask yourself, do you need to keep it? Because maybe you don't.
I think transparency is a big one. Helping the user understand what is actually going on, what is going on with their data, what is going on with their records, how long are IP addresses being stored, all these different things. But I think, and transparency, we were talking about this earlier, it means something very different to us as a storage provider than it does to my colleagues here. But I think being transparent is important, certainly for what we do, and so I would definitely put that high in the marks.
I think having a live person to be able to reach out to matters a great deal in the long run. Educational tools matter, but when all else fails, being able to talk to a person tends to help unravel situations, and probably serves well to help a user be able to fight for him or herself.
What about, it seems to me that there's another problem here, which is that, maybe not so much for Cox, but for some other folks, you guys have service providers yourselves, right? You're not alone. you rely on other people to provide you with services. Are there issues that come up with that? And if so, how do they get resolved?
So we've been around for 14 years, and we've been kicked off of, moved from, shifted to, taken down from a bunch of different upstream providers. It's sort of the nature of what we do. And we have landed on a provider in the U.S. that we really like. They consequently were also the people that were hosting WikiLeaks when WikiLeaks.org was out. So they do tend to try and stand up for their users' rights, or at least say impartial. So let's just say there's upstream providers that should recognize your right as an online service provider. First thing you want to do if you're an online service provider is register yourself as the designated copyright agent. I don't know what the terminology is, with a copyright office. That way you're the person that complaints should go to. The second thing you want to do is make sure your relationship with your upstream provider is such that they understand that they're a classification of ISP that is just a sort of transient, you know, they're just the carrier, that you are actually the classification of ISP that should be responding to takedown notices. We've hopped off of every provider at this point that tries to take care of the takedown notice procedure themselves. This is a bit of a technical detail, but become the registered organization for your IP net block. That's the de facto standard for how you figure out who has a particular IP address. So when someone's going to send a takedown notice, they'll send it to that. So try and become the person that is actually registered as the controlling person on the net block, and you likely won't get backdoored. When I say backdoored, I mean the complaints go to your ISP, not to you, and so all of a sudden, you know, this has happened to us a couple times, all of a sudden, like, every single site that we host is down because our upstream provider cut off our service. So you really have to feel it out. You have to feel out that relationship. This sort of goes to that idea, I don't know what to say, like jurisdictional diversity, but having your data in more than one place so that you don't suffer downtime as a result of this is a really good idea. And you'll eventually find service providers that are willing to work with you. And if they're not, or in the case of our service provider, the one that we're on now, this particular group of doctors tried to backdoor us by going to the service provider above us and getting them to take us down. And they just needed a little bit of confidence to assert their position as a ISP that just carries data and isn't the final destination. And to get that confidence, we called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I found out today it was actually Corinne, thank you, that wound up sort of bolstering that confidence for our ISP. She agreed that if they ran into trouble, that the EFF would step in on their behalf. And so they found what they needed there, and they allowed us to deal with the process, which is what you need. So this ISP, that the co-location provider with, is called Silicon Valley Web Host. They're in San Jose, California. They're a really good upstream provider, but I'm sure there are plenty more.
If I can add, and you know, Chris, to your point, and Randy, to a point you made earlier, perhaps in a little different way, nothing is sort of, you know, more important than actually knowing who you're talking to and communicating that, and having a real person on the other end of the line, and that goes, you know, with service providers too. You know, letting them know who you are, letting them know about your business, what you do, how you do it. I feel like is important. You know, at the end of the day, this is all, you know, we're far away from AI. These are all people here. And I think communicating with people, helping them understand what it is you're doing and why it is you're doing it, I think does matter. And you know, if someone knows that it's not just Spider Oak, but it's Ethan. Oh, well, I'll pick up the phone and call him, or I'll send him an email and let him know. That stuff does go a long way. And you know, it shouldn't be overlooked.
Yeah, I think that's probably how our relationship got so strong with our upstream provider as well. So definitely create good relationships. Send them baked goods and stuff. I don't know.
So we have about 10 minutes left. I wanted to see, are there any questions from the audience at this point? Yeah, sure. Do they need to go to the mic, or is it okay?
Or we can repeat the question, too, if you don't want to get it.
So this is for Chris. I'm kind of like I was kind of thinking it'd be fun to send a takedown notice to you just to see what comes back when you're talking about the kind of reverse threats. but what do you typically see that's missing, or what, you know, when you're sending that sort of clarification notice that very few of them come back, like what is missing typically?
So they're required to identify the exact piece of infringement on your server. So that's the piece that's generally missing. A lot of people want to use it as a sledgehammer and say, they're violating our copyright. They're not going to tell you what the copyright is. And we want you to take the site down. So don't take the site down. They have to identify, first they have to identify their copyright. Then they have to identify the exact infringement on your website and or on your service. And then I highly recommend you communicate with the user and have them put up a giant black image that says censored on it. Use a nice X-Acto knife, you know, use a surgical knife to pick that content out of the page. Don't take the entire page down. Let the world know that that particular content's been censored. Have them put the DMCA takedown notice up in its place. I mean, you know, these are things that that are typically missing when people come to us and ask for a takedown, and they're required for counter notice. So the counter notice process requires that these things all be checked off. That way, the user can say that is the misidentification of their copyright. This content is not actually, you know, infringing. So they are required. So if you're ever going to go into court, those things need to be very exact.
You know, Google actually published a report where they publicly stated, they don't give a lot of numbers. I don't know if you noticed about Google, but they like to keep their numbers close to their vest. But they said 37% of the takedown notices that they receive are improper. So it's not a small number. It's a lot. So anyway, for what it's worth.
So most of the time you've been talking about the DMCA currently, right? And perhaps, pardon me if this is a naive question, but what do we have to look out for with things like ACTA?
I mean, you know, it's so from my readings of the ACTA, so if anyone didn't hear it, we've talked about the DMCA a lot. What do we have to look out for in terms of ACTA? I'll let other people go, but it basically is like a international trade agreement. One, there's no sort of democratic process, so that's a big thing. That's a problem. If it's accepted in a country, it looks a lot like the DMCA, but I think it's arguably worse. And I think maybe Corinne can talk more about that. But I think that it does have this idea of the takedown notice, counter notice procedures in it. Actually, I'm going to yield because I don't know the details of all of the ACTA. But
well, to me, I think what's important to pay attention to is more the question of, you know, so right now, you know, if you're a startup and you're trying to help your users, and you know, it's probably enough work for you to get on top of U.S. law and how to make sure you're staying safe within it, and to also sort of try to keep track of international law seems like a lot of pressure. And unfortunately, one of the things that we found is that the folks who can't afford to send people to big meetings in international fora and spend hours there, you know, they're going to be making the decisions for the rest of us, and they're going to be making those decisions without us knowing a great deal about it. So, for example, the ACTA text was kept secret for years until finally. And, you know, I will say that EFF and a number of other civil society groups worked hard to make that treaty better than it could have been. So it's actually could be worse. but to me, I think if I was a startup, I would be feeling really uncomfortable with the fact that there were people who didn't necessarily have interests aligned with me or my customers who are making decisions that might affect my ability to do business in an international space as I am growing. Are there any other questions? We can talk separately about ACTA, but I don't want to get into the weeds of it because it might be a bit much.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be resisted.
Hopefully it'll be resisted, yes. There's a number of legal problems with it. Okay, well, listen, what I wanted to do, we sort of talked beforehand, and we came up with sort of like a checklist. And I wanted to kind of do a sum up of that checklist, some of which we've talked about, and one new idea that I just want to be on my soapbox about a little bit. It seemed to us that there are about sort of 8-9 things that everybody could do, depending on where you're positioned and what your company does, that would go a long way towards protecting your users and might not be a tremendous amount of work. One is on the side of intellectual property type threats, right? Because we just see this online over and over. You know, you just, if someone doesn't like some content, they're going to complain about it. They're going to send a DMCA notice, or they're going to do a trademark complaint, and you as an intermediary are going to be under pressure to do something about it. One of the most basic things you can do is forward that notice to the user. Let the user, if it's a DMCA notice, for example, this basic thing doesn't happen very much. Let the user know exactly who's complaining and what they're complaining about. That's really important for the user on the flip side, because they're trying to figure out how to respond. So say you do a remix video, and you might take content from lots of places, right, in making your remix. If you know that the person's complaining is the person that you only took 5 seconds of their movie, you might feel a little more comfortable about whether you can counter notice or not. So it's actually really, as a practical matter, important for the user to know who's complaining. So forward that information on. I think, you know, holding the complaining party accountable, make sure that they've actually gone, you know, met their obligations when they send a notice complaining about something, right? Because there are specific things in the DMCA that you have to meet. Don't take it down just randomly, which more people do than you would like to know. Provide educational tools for your users. Help your users help themselves. Help them stay informed, help them get informed in advance, and help them understand what they need to do to respond and what their options are. It's really, really important. And one of the great things is that right now online, there's actually a huge amount of, there's lots and lots of resources about notice, about counter notice, about fair use, about infringement. There's a lot of resources out there that you could just link to, so you don't necessarily have to develop those tools yourself.
You can link to EFF.org, as we do,
and to help people know
better what their rights are.
If the issue is trademarks, we haven't talked about this a whole lot, but trademarks are a very thorny issue because there isn't a DMTA. So one thing that can happen is that, you know, if you get a letter, a cease and desist letter saying you've got to take this down because it's infringing my trademark, a lot of companies are going to say, look, the amount of time it would take a lawyer to think about whether there's a trademark as an actual issue here is way more than this customer is ever going to pay me in 10 years. So it's just not worth it for me to do that. And that's why they do like what Facebook did when I mentioned earlier with urban homesteading. They just take it down and say, you guys work it out amongst yourselves. Let me know how that turns out. This is not a good approach. Or if it's not going to be a good approach for everybody. What you can do instead is set up a counter notice process. A number of companies have done this. The same as with copyright. Allow users with a way to respond and say, no, this is not infringing. And if they do that, very, very few people counter notice. But if they do, it probably means that they care deeply about it. Take a second look. If it seems clearly legal, you know, if it only takes more than 5 minutes of a lawyer's time to figure it out, put that material back up. And, you know, chances are you're going to be in a good legal position. A crazy person might still sue you, but a crazy person could always sue you. So, you know, that's a risk you shouldn't be, you know, hopefully that's part, unfortunately, it's part of the price of doing business. And I want you guys to add if I've missed anything. On the privacy side, if you get a subpoena, make sure you notify the user, right? We talked about that. Make sure you notify the user and you give them time to respond. A lot of times, you know, I think people don't realize that if you get a subpoena and it says you have to respond in 5 days, you don't necessarily have to respond in 5 days. You take the time and say, we have a policy of protecting our users. We'll respond to you in 21 days if we don't have a reason not to. Provide a human contact. Somewhere in your organization, have a human person who can communicate with a customer before serious action is going to be taken down, like a termination of their account. If you can do that, again, that might not scale for everybody, but if it works for you, it's something your user is going to like. Consider fighting a subpoena. If it really seems improper to you and you know, frankly, you might get some, you know, media attention about it, and you will come out and people will know that you're a person that stands up for your customers. Think hard about your data retention policy. What do you need? What do you not need? You know, it's sort of the, if you build it, they will come. Okay, if you have that data, it means someone can come and get it. And, you know, so if you don't need it, maybe you shouldn't keep it. And then sort of, I think, this general thing, as you evolve as a business, pay attention to your own service providers. Who are you relying on? And will those people have your back? Will those people have your customers' back? If not, you know, look into whether there are alternatives. This is not always an easy thing to do, but I think beginning to set up an ecosystem that's really about protecting customers is going to benefit all of us in the long term. So one of the things, and also if you are thinking here as a customer, not so much as a service provider, you should be thinking about all of these things and saying, what can I ask my service providers to do? What should I be looking for when I have a choice? You don't always have a choice, right? You might be in a place where there's only one ISP and you have no choice. But that's not always going to be true for a lot of services that you rely on. And it's worth it to take the time and figure out who's going to be a really protective group and who isn't. And give your business to the people that are, have your back. Is there anything, did I miss anything?
No, thank you.
That's good. A good summary.
That's it.
All right, well, thanks everyone for coming. I hope this is useful and you take it all and put it in place.
Well, sir.